His own intuition that they needed Andy alive was confirmed in here. The postulate Hux and his crew had based their own chain of logic on was the idea that all the powers they were interested in were exercised voluntarily, having their first cause in the willingness of the possessor to use them. And the key word was will. The girl's powers, of which pyrokinesis was only the cornerstone, had a way of getting out of control, of jumping nimbly over the barriers of her will. But this study, which incorporated all the available information, indicated that it was the girl herself who elected whether or not to set things in motion, as she had done at the Manders farm when she realized that the shop agents were trying to kill her father. He riffled through the recap of the original Lot 6 experiment. All the graphs and computer readouts boiled down to the same thing. Will as the first cause. Using will as the basis of everything, Hochstetter and his colleagues had gone through an amazing catalog of drugs before deciding on Thorazine for Andy and a new drug called Orison for the girl. 70 pages of gobbledygook in the report came down to the fact that the drugs would make them feel high, dreamy, floaty. Neither of them would be able to exercise enough will to choose between chocolate milk and white, let alone enough to start fires or convince people they were blind or whatever. They could keep Andy McGee drugged constantly. They had no real use for him. Both the report and Cap's own intuition suggested that he was a dead end, a burned-out case. It was the girl who interested them. Give me 6 months, Cap thought, and we'll have enough. Just long enough to map the terrain inside that amazing little head. No House or Senate subcommittee would be able to resist the promise of chemically induced psi powers and the enormous implications it would have on the arms race if that little girl was even half of what Wanless suspected. And there were other possibilities. They were not in the blue-backed report because they were too explosive for even a top-secret heading. Hochstetter, who had become progressively more excited as the picture took shape before him and his committee of experts, had mentioned one of these possibilities to Cap only a week ago. This Z-factor, Hochstetter said. Have you considered any of the ramifications if it turns out that the child isn't a mule, but a genuine mutation? Cap had, although he did not tell Hochstetter that. He had raised the interesting question of eugenics. The potentially explosive question of eugenics, with its lingering connotations of Nazism and super races, all the things Americans had fought World War II to put an end to. But it was one thing to sink a philosophical well and produce a gusher of bullshit about usurping the power of God, and quite another to produce laboratory evidence that the offspring of Lot 6 parents might be human torches, levitators, tele or telempaths, or God only knew what else. Ideals were cheap things to hold as long as there were no solid arguments for their overthrow. If there were, what then? Human breeding farms? As crazy as it sounded, Cap could visualize it. It could be the key to everything. World peace or world domination. And when you got rid of the trick mirrors of rhetoric and bombast, weren't they really the same thing? It was a whole can of worms. The possibilities stretched a dozen years into the future. Cap knew the best he himself could realistically hope for was 6 months, but it might be enough to set policy, to survey the land on which the tracks would be laid and the railroad would run. It would be his legacy to the country and to the world. Measured against this, the lives of a runaway college instructor and his ragamuffin daughter were less than dust in the wind. The girl could not be tested and observed with any degree of validity if she was constantly drugged. But her father would be their hostage to fortune. And on the few occasions they wanted to run tests on him, the reverse would hold. It was a simple system of levers. And as Archimedes had observed, a lever long enough would move the world. The intercom buzzed. John Rainbird is here, the new girl said. Her usual bland receptionist's tone was threadbare enough to show the fear beneath. On that one, I don't blame you, babe, Cap thought. Send him in, please. 2. Same old Rainbird. He came in slowly, dressed in a brown and balding leather jacket over a faded plaid shirt. Old and scuffed dingoes peeked out from beneath the cuffs of his faded straight-leg jeans. The top of his huge head seemed almost to brush the ceiling. The gored ruin of his empty eye socket made Cap shudder inwardly. "Cap," he said and sat down, "I have been in the desert too long." "I've heard about your Flagstaff house," Cap said. "And your shoe collection." John Rainbird only stared at him unblinkingly with his good eye. "How come I never see you in anything but those old shit-kickers?" Cap asked. Rainbird smiled thinly and said nothing. The old unease filled Cap, and he found himself wondering again how much Rainbird knew and why it bothered him so much. "I have a job for you," he said. "Good. Is it the one I want?" Cap looked at him, surprised, considering, and then said, "I think it is." "Then tell me, Cap." Cap outlined the plan that would bring Andy and Charlie McGee to Longmont. It didn't take long. "Can you use the gun?" he asked when he was finished.
"I can use any gun. And your plan is a good one. It will succeed."
"How nice of you to give it your stamp of approval," Cap said. He tried for a light irony and only succeeded in sounding petulant. "God damn the man anyway."
"And I will fire the gun," Rainbird said.
"On one condition." Cap stood up, planted his hands on his desk, which was littered with components from the McGee file, and leaned toward Rainbird.
"No," he said. "You don't make conditions with me."
"I do this time," Rainbird said.
"But you will find it an easy one to fulfill, I think."
"No," Cap repeated. Suddenly his heart was hammering in his chest, although with fear or anger he was not sure. "You misunderstand. I am in charge of this agency and this facility. I am your superior. I believe you spent enough time in the Army to understand the concept of a superior officer."
"Yes," Rainbird said, smiling.
"I scragged one or two in my time. Once directly on shop orders."
"Your orders, Cap."
"Is that a threat?" Cap cried. Some part of him was aware that he was overreacting, but he seemed unable to help himself.
"God damn you, is that a threat? If it is, I think you've lost your senses completely. If I decide I don't want you to leave this building, all I have to do is press a button. There are 30 men who can fire that rifle,
but none can fire it with such assurance as this one-eyed red nigger," Rainbird said. His gentle tone had not changed.
"You think you have them now, Cap. But they are will-o'-the-wisps. Whatever gods there are may not want you to have them. They may not want you to set them down in your rooms of deviltry and emptiness. You have thought you had them before."
He pointed to the file material heaped on the library trolley and then to the blue-backed folder.
"I've read the material. And I've read your Dr. Hockstetter's report."
"The devil you have!" Cap exclaimed, but he could see the truth in Rainbird's face. He had. Somehow, he had. "Who gave it to him?" he raged. "Who?"
"Oh, yes," Rainbird said. "I have what I want. When I want it. People give it to me. I think it must be my pretty face."
His smile widened and became suddenly horribly predatory. His good eye rolled in its socket.
"What are you saying to me?"
Cap asked. He wanted a glass of water.
"Just that I have had a long time in Arizona to walk and smell the winds that blow. And for you, Cap, it smells bitter, like the wind off an alkali flat. I had time to do a lot of reading and a lot of thinking. And what I think is that I may be the only man in all the world who can surely bring those two here. And it may be that I am the only man in all the world who can do something with the little girl once she's here. Your fat report, your Thorazine, and your Orazin. There may be more here than drugs can cope with, more dangers than you can understand."
Hearing Rainbird was like hearing the ghost of Wanless, and Cap was now in the grip of such fear and such fury that he couldn't speak.
"I will do all this," Rainbird said kindly. "I will bring them here, and you will do all your tests."
He was like a father giving a child permission to play with some new toy.
"On the condition that you give the girl to me for disposal when you are finished with her."
"You're mad," Cap whispered.
How right you are, Rainbird said and laughed. So are you, mad as a hatter. You sit here and make your plans for controlling a force beyond your comprehension, a force that belongs only to the gods themselves, and to this one little girl. And what's to stop me from having you erased, right here and now? My word, Rainbird said, that if I disappear, such a shockwave of revulsion and indignation will run through this country within the month that Watergate will look like the filching of penny candy in comparison. My word that if I disappear, the shop will cease to exist within 6 weeks, and that within 6 months, you will stand before a judge for sentencing on crimes serious enough to keep you behind bars for the rest of your life. He smiled again, showing crooked tombstone teeth. Do not doubt me, Cap. My days in this reeking, putrescent vineyard have been long, and the vintage would be a bitter one indeed. Cap tried to laugh. What came out was a choked snarl. For over 10 years I have been putting my nuts and forage by, Rainbird said serenely, like any animal that has known winter and remembers it. I have such a potpourri, Cap. Photos, tapes, Xerox copies of documents that would make the blood of our good friend John Q. Public run cold. None of that is possible, Cap said, but he knew Rainbird was not bluffing, and he felt as if a cold, invisible hand were pressing down on his chest. All very possible, Rainbird said. For the last 3 years I've been in a state of information passing gear, because for the last 3 years I've been able to tap into your computer whenever I liked. On a time-sharing basis, of course, which makes it expensive. But I have been able to pay. My wages have been very fine, and with investment they have grown. I stand before you, Cap, or sit, which is the truth, but less poetic, as a triumphant example of American free enterprise in action. No, Cap said. Yes, Rainbird replied. I am John Rainbird, but I am also the U.S. Bureau for Geological Understudies. Check, if you like. My computer code is Axon. Check the time-sharing codes in your main terminal. Take the elevator. I'll wait. Rainbird crossed his legs and the cuff of his right pants leg pulled up, revealing a rip and a bulge in the seam of one of his boots. He looked like a man who could wait out the age, if that were necessary. Cap's mind was whirling. Access to the computer on a time-sharing basis, perhaps? That still doesn't tap you into... Go see Dr. Noftzeger, Rainbird said kindly. Ask him how many ways there are to tap into a computer once you have access on a time-sharing basis. 2 years ago, a bright 12-year-old tapped into the USC computer. And, by the way, I know your access code, Cap. It's Brow this year. Last year it was RASP. I thought that was much more appropriate. Cap sat and looked at Rainbird. His mind had divided, it seemed, had become a three-ring circus. Part of it was marveling that he had never heard John Rainbird say so much at one time. Part of it was trying to grapple with the idea that this maniac knew all of the shop's business. A third part was remembering a Chinese curse, a curse that sounded deceptively pleasant until you sat down and really thought about it. May you live in interesting times. For the last year and a half, he had lived in extremely interesting times. He felt that just one more interesting thing would drive him totally insane. And then he thought of Wanless again, with dragging, dawning horror. He felt almost as if he were turning into Wanless, beset with demons on every side, but helpless to fight them off, or even to enlist help. What do you want, Rainbird? I've told you already, Cap. I want nothing but your word that my involvement with this girl, Charlene McGee, will not end with the rifle, but begin there. I want to... Rainbird's eye darkened and became thoughtful, moody, introspective. I want to know her intimately. Cap looked at him, horror-struck. Rainbird understood suddenly, and he shook his head at Cap contemptuously. Not that intimately, not in the biblical sense. But I'll know her. She and I are going to be friends, Cap. If she is as powerful as all things indicate, she and I are going to be great friends. Cap made a sound of humor, not a laugh exactly, more of a shrill giggle. The expression of contempt on Rainbird's face did not change. No, of course you don't think that is possible. You look at my face and you see a monster. You look at my hands and you see them covered with the blood you ordered me to spill. But I tell you, Cap, it will happen. The girl has had no friend for going on 2 years. She has had her father, and that is all. You see her as you see me, Cap. It is your great failing. You look, you see a monster. Only in the girl's case, you see a useful monster. Perhaps this is because you are a white man. White men see monsters everywhere. White men look at their own pricks and see monsters. Rainbird laughed again. Cap had at last begun to calm down and to think reasonably. Why should I allow it, even if all you say is true? Your days are numbered, and we both know it. You've been hunting your own death for 20 years. Anything else has been incidental, only a hobby. You'll find it soon enough, and then it ends for all of us. So why should I give you the pleasure of having what you want? Perhaps it's as you say. Perhaps I have been hunting my own death. A more colorful phrase than I would have expected from you, Cap. Maybe you should have the fear of God put into you more often. You're not my idea of God, Cap said. Rainbird grinned. More like the Christian devil, sure. But I tell you this. If I had really been hunting my own death, I believe I would have found it long before this. Perhaps I've been stalking it for play. But I have no desire to bring you down, Cap, or the shop, or U.S. domestic intelligence. I am no idealist. I only want this little girl. And you may find you need me. You may find that I am able to accomplish things that all the drugs in Dr. Hochstetter's cabinet will not. And in return, when the affair of the McGees ends, the U.S. Bureau for Geological Understudies will cease to exist. Your computer chief, Knopf Zeger, can change all his codings. And you, Cap, will fly to Arizona with me on a public airline. We will enjoy a good dinner at my favorite Flagstaff restaurant. And then we will go back to my house. And behind it, in the desert, we will start a fire of our own and barbecue a great many papers and tapes and films. I will even show you my shoe collection, if you like. Cap thought it over. Rainbird gave him time, sitting calmly. At last Cap said, Hochstetter and his colleagues suggest it may take 2 years to open the girl up completely. It depends on how deeply her protective inhibitions go. And you will be gone in 4 to 6 months. Cap shrugged. Rainbird touched the side of his nose with one index finger and cocked his head, a grotesque fairy tale gesture. I think we can keep you in the saddle much longer than that, Cap. Between the two of us, we know where hundreds of bodies are buried, literally as well as figuratively. And I doubt if it will take years. We'll both get what we want in the end. What do you say? Cap thought about it. He felt old and tired and at a complete loss. I guess, he said, that you have made yourself a deal. Fine, Rainbird said briskly. I will be the girl's orderly, I think. No one at all in the established scheme of things. That will be important to her. And, of course, she will never know I was the one who fired the rifle. That would be dangerous knowledge, wouldn't it? Very dangerous. Why, Cap said finally, why have you gone to these insane lengths? Do they seem insane? Rainbird asked lightly. He got up and took one of the pictures from Cap's desk. It was the photo of Charlie sliding down the slope of crusted snow on her flattened cardboard box, laughing. We all put our nuts and forage by for winter in this business, Cap. Hoover did it. So did CIA directors beyond counting. So have you, or you would be drawing a pension right now. When I began, Charlene McGee wasn't even born, and I was only covering my own ass.
But why the girl?
Rainbird didn't answer for a long time. He was looking at the photograph carefully, almost tenderly. He touched it. She is very beautiful, he said, and very young. Yet inside her is your Z factor, the power of the gods. She and I will be close.
His eye grew dreamy.
Yes, we will be very close.
In the box. 1. On March 27th, Andy McGee decided abruptly that they could stay in Tashmore no longer. It had been more than 2 weeks since he had mailed his letters, and if anything was going to come of them, it already would have. The very fact of the continuing silence around Granther's camp made him uneasy. He supposed he could simply have been dismissed out of hand as a crackpot in every case, but he didn't believe it. What he believed, what his deepest intuition whispered, was that his letters had been somehow diverted, and that would mean they knew where he and Charlie were.
We're going, he told Charlie. Let's get our stuff together. She only looked at him with her careful eyes, a little scared, and said nothing. She didn't ask him where they were going or what they were going to do, and that made him nervous too. In one of the closets, he had found two old suitcases plastered with ancient vacation decals, Grand Rapids, Niagara Falls, Miami Beach, and the two of them began to sort what they would take and what they would leave. Blinding bright sunlight streamed in through the windows on the east side of the cottage. Water dripped and gurgled in the downspouts. The night before, he had got little sleep. The ice had gone out, and he had lain awake listening to it. The high, ethereal, and somehow uncanny sound of the old yellow ice splitting and moving slowly down toward the neck of the pond, where the great Hancock River spilled eastward across New Hampshire and all of Maine, growing progressively more smelly and polluted until it vomited, noisome and dead, into the Atlantic. The sound was like a prolonged crystal note, or perhaps that of a bow drawn endlessly across a high violin string, a constant fluted zing that settled over the nerve endings and seemed to make them vibrate in sympathy. He had never been here at Ice Out before and was not sure he would ever want to be again. There was something terrible and otherworldly about that sound as it vibrated between the silent evergreen walls of this low and eroded bowl of hills. He felt that they were very near again, like the barely seen monster in a recurring nightmare. The day after Charlie's birthday, he had been on one of his tramps, the cross-country skis buckled uncomfortably onto his feet, and he'd come across a line of snowshoe tracks leading up to a tall spruce tree. There were indents in the crust like periods where the snowshoes had been taken off and jammed into the snow on their tails. There was a flurried confusion where the wearer had later refastened his snowshoes. Slush boats, Granther had always called them, holding them in contempt for some obscure reason of his own. At the base of the tree, Andy had found 6 Vantage cigarette butts and a crumpled yellow package that had once contained Kodak Tri-X film. More uneasy than ever, he had taken off the skis and climbed up into the tree. Halfway up, he had found himself on a direct line of sight with Granther's cottage a mile away. It was small and apparently empty, but with a telephoto lens. He hadn't mentioned his find to Charlie. The suitcases were packed. Her continued silence forced him into nervous speech, as if by not talking she was accusing him. "We're going to hitch a ride into Berlin," he said, "and then we'll get a Greyhound back to New York City. We're going to the offices of the New York Times."
"But, Daddy, you sent them a letter."
"Honey, they might not have gotten it." She looked at him in silence for a moment and then said,
"Do you think they took it?"
"Of course," and he shook his head and started again. "Charlie, I just don't know." Charlie didn't reply. She knelt, closed one of the suitcases, and began fumbling ineffectually with the clasps. "Let me help you, hon."
"I can do it,"
she screamed at him, and then began to cry. "Charlie, don't," he said. "Please, hon, it's almost over."
"No, it's not," she said, crying harder. "It's never going to be over."
2. There were an even dozen agents around Granther McGee's cabin. They had taken up their positions the night before. They all wore mottled white and green clothing. None of them had been at the Manders farm, and none of them was armed except for John Rainbird, who had the rifle, and Don Jules, who carried a .22 pistol. "I am taking no chances of having someone panic because of what happened back in New York," Rainbird had told Cap. "That Jameson still looks as if his balls are hanging around his knees." Similarly, he would not hear of the agents going armed. Things had a way of happening, and he didn't want to come out of the operation with two corpses. He had handpicked all of the agents, and the one he had chosen to take Andy McGee was Don Jules. Jules was small, 30-ish, silent, morose. He was good at his job. Rainbird knew because Jules was the only man he had chosen to work with more than once. He was quick and practical. He did not get in the way at critical moments. "McGee will be out at some point during the day," Rainbird had told them at the briefing. "The girl usually comes out, but McGee always does. If the man comes out alone, I'll take him, and Jules will get him out of sight quickly and quietly. If the girl should come out alone, same thing. If they come out together, I'll take the girl, and Jules will take McGee. The rest of you are just spear carriers. Do you understand that?" Rainbird's eye glared over them. "You're there in case something goes drastically wrong, and that is all. Of course, if something does go drastically wrong, most of you will be running for the lake with your pants on fire. You're along in case that one chance in 100 turns up where you can do something. Of course, it's understood that you're also along as observers and witnesses in case I fuck up." This had earned a thin and nervous chuckle. Rainbird raised one finger. "If any one of you miscues and puts their wind up somehow, I'll personally see that you end up in the lousiest jungle valley of South America I can find, with a cord asshole. Believe that, gentlemen. You are spear carriers in my show. Remember it." Later, at their staging area, an abandoned motel in St. Johnsbury, Rainbird had taken Don Jules aside. "You have read the file on this man," Rainbird said. Jules was smoking a Camel. "Yeah." "You understand the concept of mental domination?"
"Yeah."
"You understand what happened to the two men in Ohio? The men that tried to take his daughter away?"
"I worked with George Waring," Jules said evenly. "That guy could burn water making tea.
In this man's outfit, that is not so unusual. I only need us to be clear. You will need to be very quick."
"Yeah, okay."
"He's had a whole winter to rest, this guy. If he gets time to give you a shot, you're a good candidate to spend the next 3 years of your life in a padded room, thinking you're a bird or a turnip or something."
"All right."
"All right, what?"
"I'll be quick. Give it a rest, John."
"There's a good chance that they will come out together," Rainbird said, ignoring him. "You'll be around the corner of the porch, out of sight of the door where they'll come out. You wait for me to take the girl. Her father will go to her. You'll be behind him. Get him in the neck."
"Sure."
"Don't screw this up, Don." Jules smiled briefly and smoked.
"No," he said.
3. The suitcases were packed. Charlie had put on her coat and her snow pants. Andy shrugged into his own jacket, zipped it, and picked up the suitcases. He didn't feel good. Not at all good. He had the jumps, one of his hunches.
"You feel it too, don't you?"
Charlie asked. Her face was pale and expressionless. Andy nodded reluctantly.
"What do we do?"
"We hope the feeling's a little early," he said, although in his heart he didn't think it was so. "What else can we do?"
"What else can we do?" she echoed.
She came to him then and lifted her arms to be picked up, something he could not remember her doing for a long time, maybe 2 years. It was amazing how time got by, how quickly a child could change in front of your eyes with an unobtrusiveness that was nearly terrible. He put the suitcases down and picked her up and hugged her. She kissed his cheek and then hugged him again very tightly.
"Are you ready?"
he asked, setting her down.
"I guess so,"
Charlie said. She was close to tears again.
"Daddy, I won't make fires. Not even if they come before we can get away.
Yes, he said. That's all right, Charlie. I understand that. I love you, Dad.
He nodded. I love you too, kiddo.
Andy went to the door and opened it. For a moment, the sunlight was so bright that he could see nothing at all. Then his pupils contracted and the day cleared before him, bright with melting snow. To his right was Tashmore Pond, dazzling, jaggedly irregular patches of blue water showing between the floating chunks of ice. Straight ahead were pine woods. Through them, he could barely see the green shingled roof of the next camp, free of snow at last. The woods were still, and Andy's feeling of disquiet intensified. Where was the bird song that had greeted their mornings ever since the winter temperatures had begun to moderate? There was none today, only the drip of snow melting from the branches. He found himself wishing desperately that Granther had put in a phone out here. He had to restrain an urge to shout, "Who's there?" at the top of his lungs, but that would only frighten Charlie more. "Looks fine," he said. "I think we're still ahead of them, if they're coming at all."
"That's good," she said colorlessly.
"Let's hit the road, kid," Andy said, and thought for the 100th time, "What else is there to do?" And thought again how much he hated them. Charlie came across the room to him, past the drainer full of dishes they had washed that morning after breakfast. The entire cottage was the way they had found it, spick and span. Granther would have been pleased. Andy slipped an arm around Charlie's shoulders and gave her one more brief hug. Then he picked up the suitcases, and they stepped out into the early spring sunshine together. 4. John Rainbird was halfway up a tall spruce 150 yards away. He was wearing lineman's spikes on his feet, and a lineman's belt held him firmly against the trunk of the tree. When the cabin door opened, he threw the rifle to his shoulder and seated it firmly. Total calm fell over him in a reassuring cloak. Everything became startlingly clear in front of his one good eye. When he lost his other eye, he had suffered a blurring of his depth perception. But at moments of extreme concentration, like this one, his old, clear seeing came back to him. It was as if the ruined eye could regenerate itself for brief periods. It was not a long shot, and he would not have wasted a moment's worry if it had been a bullet he was planning to put through the girl's neck. But he was dealing with something far more clumsy, something that jumped the risk element by a factor of 10. Fixed inside the barrel of this specially modified rifle was a dart tipped with an ampule of orosin, and at this distance there was always a chance it might tumble or veer. Luckily, the day was almost without wind. "If it is the will of the Great Spirit and of my ancestors," Rainbird prayed silently, "guide my hands and my eye that the shot may be true." The girl came out with her father by her side. Jules was in it then. Through the telescopic sight, the girl looked as big as a barn door. The parka was a bright blue blaze against the weathered boards of the cabin. Rainbird had a moment to note the suitcases in McGee's hands, to realize they were just in time after all. The girl's hood was down, the tab of her zipper pulled up only to her breastbone, so that the coat spread open slightly at the throat. The day was warm, and that was in his favor, too. He tightened down on the trigger and sighted the crosshairs on the base of her throat. "If it is the will..." He squeezed the trigger. There was no explosion, only a hollow "phut," and a small curl of smoke from the rifle's breech. 5. They were on the edge of the steps when Charlie suddenly stopped and made a strangled swallowing noise. Andy dropped the suitcases immediately. He had heard nothing, but something was terribly wrong. Something about Charlie had changed. "Charlie? Charlie?" He stared at her. She stood as still as a statue, incredibly beautiful against the bright snowfield, incredibly small. And suddenly he realized what the change was. It was so fundamental, so awful, that he had not been able to grasp it at first. What appeared to be a long needle was sticking out of Charlie's throat just below the Adam's apple. Her mittened hand groped for it, found it, twisted it to a new and grotesque upward-jutting angle. A thin trickle of blood began to flow from the wound and down the side of her throat. A flower of blood, small and delicate, stained the collar of her shirt and just touched the edging of fake fur that bordered the zipper of her parka. "Charlie!" he screamed.
He leaped forward and grabbed her arm just as her eyes rolled up and she pitched outward. He led her down to the porch, crying her name over and over. The dart in her throat twinkled brightly in the sun. Her body had the loose, boneless feel of a dead thing. He held her, cradled her, and looked out at the sunshiny woods that seemed so empty, and where no birds sang. "Who did it?" he screamed. "Who did it? Come out where I can see you." Don Jules stepped around the corner of the porch. He was wearing Adidas tennis sneakers. He held the .22 in one hand. "Who shot my daughter?" Andy screamed. Something in his throat vibrated painfully with the force of his scream. He held her to him, so terribly loose and boneless inside her warm blue parka. His fingers went to the dart and pulled it out, starting a fresh trickle of blood. "Get her inside," he thought. "Got to get her inside." Jules approached him and shot him in the back of the neck, much as the actor Booth had once shot a president. For a moment, Andy jerked upward on his knees, holding Charlie even more tightly against him. Then he collapsed forward over her. Jules looked at him closely, then waved the men out of the woods. "Nothing to it," he said to himself as Rainbird came toward the cabin, wading through the sticky, melting snow of late March. "Nothing to it. What was all the fuss about?" The blackout. 1. The chain of events that ended in such destruction and loss of life began with a summer storm and the failure of two generators. The storm came on August 19th, almost 5 months after Andy and Charlie were taken at Granther's camp in Vermont. For 10 days, the weather had been sticky and still. That August day, the thunderheads began to pile up shortly after noon, but nobody who worked on the grounds of the two handsome antebellum homes which faced each other across the rolling expanse of green lawn and manicured flower beds believed that the thunderheads were telling the truth. Not the groundsmen astride their lawn boys, not the woman who was in charge of computer subsections A to E, as well as the computer room coffee maker, who took one of the horses and cantered it lovingly along the well-kept bridle paths during her lunch hour. Certainly not Cap, who ate a hero sandwich in his air-conditioned office and was right on working on next year's budget, oblivious of the heat and humidity outside. Perhaps the only person in the shop compound at Longmont that day who thought it really would rain was the man who had been named for the rain. The big Indian drove in at 12:30, prefatory to clocking in at 1. His bones and the shredded hollow where his left eye had been ached when rain was on the way. He was driving a very old and rusty Thunderbird with a D parking sticker on the windshield. He was dressed in orderly's whites. Before he got out of the car, he put on an embroidered eye patch. He wore it when he was on the job because of the girl, but only then. It bothered him. It was only the patch that made him think about the lost eye. There were 4 parking lots inside the shop enclave. Rainbird's personal car, a new yellow Cadillac that ran on diesel fuel, bore an A sticker. A was the VIP parking lot, located beneath the southernmost of the 2 plantation houses. An underground tunnel and elevator system connected the VIP lot directly with the computer room, the situation rooms, the extensive shop library and newsrooms, and, of course, the visitors' quarters, a nondescript name for the complex of laboratories and nearby apartments where Charlie McGee and her father were being kept. The B lot was for second echelon employees. It was farther away. C parking lot was for secretaries, mechanics, electricians, and the like. It was farther away still. D lot was for unskilled employees. Spear carriers, in Rainbird's own terms. It was almost half a mile from anything, and always filled with a sad and motley collection of Detroit rolling iron, only a step and a half away from the weekly demo derby at Jackson Plains, the nearby stock car track. The bureaucratic pecking order, Rainbird thought, locking his wreck of a T-bird and tilting his head up to look at the thunderheads. The storm was coming. It would arrive around 4 o'clock, he reckoned. He began to walk toward the small Quonset hut set tastefully back in a grove of sugar pines where low-level employees, class 5s and 6s, punched in. His whites flapped around him. A gardener putted by him on one of the groundskeeping department's dozen or so riding lawnmowers. A gaily colored sun parasol fluttered above the seat. The gardener took no notice of Rainbird. That was also part of the bureaucratic pecking order. If you were a class 4, a class 5 became invisible.
Not even Rainbird's half-destroyed face caused much comment. Like every other government agency, the shop hired enough vets to look good. Max Factor had little to teach the U.S. government about good cosmetics. And it went without saying that a vet with some visible disability, a prosthetic arm, a motorized wheelchair, a scrambled face, was worth any three vets who looked normal. Rainbird knew men who had had their minds and spirits mauled as badly as his own face had been in the Vietnam traveling house party. Men who would have been happy to find a job clerking in a Piggly Wiggly. But they just didn't look right. Not that Rainbird had any sympathy for them. In fact, he found the whole thing rather funny. Nor was he recognized by any of the people he now worked with as a former shop agent and hatchet man. He would have sworn to that. Until 17 weeks ago, he had been only a shadow shape behind his yellow Cadillac's polarized windshield, just someone else with an A clearance. "Don't you think you're going overboard with this a bit?" Cap'n asked. "The girl has no connection with the Gardeners or the Steno Pool. You're only on stage with her." Rainbird shook his head. All it would take is a single slip. One person to mention just casually that the friendly orderly with the messed-up face parks his car in the VIP lot and changes to his whites in the executive washroom. What I'm trying to build here is a sense of trust, that trust to be based on the idea that we're both outsiders, both freaks, if you will, buried in the bowels of the KGB's American branch. Cap hadn't liked that. He didn't like anyone taking cheap shots at the shop's methods, particularly in this case, where the methods were admittedly extreme. "Well, you're sure doing one hell of a job," Cap had answered. And to that there was no satisfactory answer, because in fact he wasn't doing a hell of a job. The girl had not done so much as light a match in all the time she had been here, and the same could be said for her father, who had demonstrated not the slightest sign of any mental domination ability, if the ability still existed within him. More and more, they were coming to doubt that it did. The girl fascinated Rainbird. The first year he had been with the shop, he had taken a series of courses not to be found in any college curriculum. Wiretapping, car theft, unobtrusive search, a dozen others. The only one that had engaged Rainbird's attention fully was a course in safe cracking, taught by an aging burglar named G.M. Ramadan. Ramadan had been sprung from an institution in Atlanta for the specific purpose of teaching this craft to new shop agents. He was supposed to be the best in the business, and Rainbird would not have doubted that, although he believed that by now he was almost Ramadan's equal. Ramadan, who had died 3 years ago, Rainbird had sent flowers to his funeral. What a comedy life could sometimes be. Had taught them about Skidmore locks, about square door boxes, about secondary locking devices that can permanently freeze a safe's tumblers if the combination dial is knocked off with a hammer and chisel. He had taught them about barrel boxes and niggerheads and cutting keys, the many uses of graphite, how you could take a key impression with a Brillo pad, and how to make bathtub nitroglycerin, and how to peel a box from the back, one layer at a time. Rainbird had responded to G.M. Ramadan with a cold and cynical enthusiasm. Ramadan had said once that safes were like women. Given the tools and the time, any box could be opened. There were, he said, tough cracks and easy cracks, but no impossible cracks. This girl was tough. At first they had had to feed Charlie intravenously just to keep her from starving herself to death. After a while, she began to understand that not eating was gaining her nothing but a lot of bruises on the insides of her elbows, and she began to eat, not with any enthusiasm, but simply because using her mouth was less painful. She read some of the books that were given her, leafed through them, at any rate, and would sometimes turn on the color TV in her room, only to turn it off again a few minutes later. She had watched a local movie presentation of Black Beauty all the way through in June, and she had sat through The Wonderful World of Disney once or twice. That was all. On her weekly reports, the phrase sporadic aphasia had begun to crop up more and more often. Rainbird had looked up the term in a medical dictionary and understood it at once.
because of his own experiences as Indian and warrior. He understood it perhaps better than the doctors themselves. Sometimes the girl ran out of words. She would simply stand there, not a bit upset, her mouth working soundlessly. And sometimes she would use a totally out-of-context word, apparently without realizing it at all. "I don't like this dress. I'd rather have the hay one." Sometimes she would correct herself absently. "I mean the green one." But more often it would simply pass unnoticed. According to the dictionary, aphasia was forgetfulness caused by some cerebral disorder. The doctors had immediately begun monkeying with her medication. Orison was changed to Valium, with no appreciable change for the better. Valium and Orison were tried together, but an unforeseen interaction between the two had caused her to cry steadily and monotonously until the dose wore off. A brand new drug, a combination tranquilizer and light hallucinogenic, was tried and seemed to help for a while. Then she began to stutter and broke out in a light rash. Currently, she was back on...